Hey, hockey fans. Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Evangelical Dark Web. Tonight, we got a special guest. I posted this online, and it's definitely true. Like, I don't think anyone's more well-researched on, you know, Israeli influence in the church than J.D. Hall. So he joins us tonight to talk about his latest projects. One of them involves Michael Brown and kind of a response to his ministry and recent work that he's done. And he's got some other things going on as well. So how are you doing tonight?
Good, man. It's good to be with you.
Yeah. So, yeah, I just got to say, first of all, like, congrats on being able to do Substack full time. That's a pretty major accomplishment for someone to make money off of their own writing, especially in these days. So, you know, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. I'm very excited about that. So I didn't expect the Substack to grow like it did. So just super thankful about that.
Yeah, so anyway, you wanted to talk about Michael Brown and you have like a critique of his, you know, Christian anti-Semitism. You've written an ebook on this. So how about you just give us the rundown on what the premise is and why you thought it was important to tackle this topic?
Yeah, so Michael Brown wrote a book entitled Christian Anti-Semitism. And of course, if you followed Michael Brown's ministry for any period of time, you understand that he is a converted Jew. So, I mean, it would make sense that he would write something along those lines. It's pretty inexcusable, however, what he's doing in the book, which when I saw the chapter title on the Talmud, I did not think that he would actually give a full-throated defense of the Talmud, but that's exactly what he did. And so I did a chapter-by-chapter retort. The ebook is called Critiquing Christian Anti-Semitism, where basically I just go all the way through the book, challenging his various assumptions, which is what I would call the neo-Judaizing heresy. Although, to be fair, there's really not much neo about it. When you look at dispensational Zionism, say on X, for example, what you see there is not really neo. It's the same type of Judaism that John Chrysostom dealt with in the third century. It's exactly what the Apostle Paul dealt with in the first century. It's straight up Judaizing, which, to give a simple definition, it is the promotion of the idea that ethnic Jews have covenant blessings or promises outside or without faith in Jesus Christ. In other words, they have a covenant and the blessings and the promises that go along with that covenant without having to have faith in Jesus. But Brown goes even further than the typical dispensational Zionist or the typical neo-Judaizer, and that is a defense of the Talmud.
Yeah. What you're saying is this is not you know, average, ordinary, Christian Zionism. This is advanced Christian Zionism. And how would you distinct what you're describing from, you know, the Galatian heresy in the Judaizers in the first century? Do you think that the way you defined it seemed like it was different, but you also kind of alluded to it being there, you know, this is kind of a continuous trend throughout church history.
So what you see today is people very invested in defining Judaizing as telling Gentiles that they have to follow Jewish laws, the ceremonial rites of the cultic religion of ancient Israel in order to be saved. But that's only one component of Judaizing. Judaizing is actually much more broad than that. And so I think a lot of people think, well, this isn't Judaizing per se, because, you know, Michael Brown isn't telling Gentiles that we have to become Jewish in order to be a Christian. So this isn't Judaizing. That was just one characteristic of Judaizing that we see in Galatians. But the overall doctrinal fault is a belief that the ethnic lineage of Jews gives them something that Gentiles do not have. It is the idea, plainly put, that God is a respecter of persons. You know, that phrase is used four times in the New Testament. Three of those four times the phrase is used, it's a direct reference to Jews. And the claim, of course, is that God doesn't care one bit when he looks at a person, when he evaluates their soul, when he judges their works, their personal righteousness, or their faith before him. Doesn't matter one bit whether they're Jew or Gentile. So at the heart of Judaizing is what I would call Jewish specialism. It's the idea that they are special before God in a way that Gentiles are not.
Now, isn't this sort of inherent to dispensationalism as classically understood, that there's a distinction between Gentile and Jewish believers in the new heavens and new earth or the millennial kingdom? I'm a little fuzzy on the timeline, but, you know, they do believe that there's a distinction that exists in, you know, post-death and, you know, when believers are resurrected.
Right. So if we discuss dispensationalism, premillennial dispensationalism, you and I are at a bit of a disadvantage. What I mean by that is, since the Reformed resurgence started in about 2006 or so, there was a coalescing of Calvinists and the pseudo-Reformed from all over the evangelical world, where we really circled our wagons around one another, and the Reformed resurgence took shape and began to take on steam. It began to grow. And as a part of this coalition, the covenant theologians, meaning Presbyterians and 1689 Baptists, Reformed Baptists, 1689 Federalists, those who hold to historic Orthodox covenant theology, we put our guard down when it came to dispensationalism, and gave certain Calvinists who were dispensationalists a pass. So unfortunately for most of us, history began the day that we're born, and we're very unfamiliar with what came before. What I mean by that is, there was a time when a covenant theologian would take great exception with sharing the stage or endorsing in any way a dispensationalist. That would have been very verboten for most of church history after the invention of dispensationalism. It was very much two different camps, okay?
So you're talking like the time of Moody and...
Yeah,
like
absolutely. And Dallas Theological Seminary and so forth. That was the big dividing line. But the Reformed resurgence, it was almost like a truce. Like, okay, if you're a Calvinist, we're not going to care so much if you're a dispensationalist. So it's like you're Reformed light. And so, you know, we have pretty much venerated Dr. John MacArthur, who admittedly was a great guy. And I have defended John MacArthur more than probably anyone that you know actively out. Like, I have so many scars on account of me sticking up for John MacArthur over the years. But we kind of gave a pass to it. We acted like it was no big deal. So today, when we talk about the dangers of dispensationalism, people are like, well, come on, how bad could it be? I mean, we have John MacArthur on a pedestal. He's a dispensationalist. How bad could it be? So when we say things like all dispensationalism is dual covenant theology, you have people that greet us with a great deal of skepticism because they've not heard that before. When they hear the term dual covenant theology, they think of someone like John Hagee, who believes Jews don't even need Jesus, right, in order to be saved.
I might say he's worse than that, because he kind of believes in that Christianity exists to pay tribute to Judaism. Like I might think that's actually worse.
Hagee is on a whole different level,
like,
for sure.
I mean, that's like prosperity gospel. Like that, you know, or that's worse than the prosperity gospel.
Yeah, John Hagee in the organization that he founded, which is Christians United for Israel, CUFI, it'll go down in history as perhaps one of the greatest movements of full-blown, like full-throttle Judaizing that the world's ever known. And he is obviously a rank heretic. And so if I say, listen, in some ways, John MacArthur and John Hagee are in the same camp, you know, I'm going to get pelted with rotten fruit for that. But here's where I was going with that. They're both dual covenant theologians. Every dispensationalist is a dual covenant theologian. What I mean by that is they believe that there is a separate covenant that is given to Jews by which they are God's chosen people in the same way that we're God's chosen. Well, perhaps not in the same way that we're God's chosen people, but that they are still God's chosen. They have a covenant. They have blessings and promises that go along with that covenant that they have access to. It's made available to them without faith in Jesus Christ. That's two covenants, one for Gentiles, one for Jews.
I think the proof text for that kind of comes in Jeremiah 31, when it's like, I will establish a new covenant. And if you don't think that that's Christ referring to the, you know, what, you know, that's what Christ is sort of alluding to at the Last Supper. It's like, that's, you know, when he says, you know, this is my covenant. So right. They believe that, you know, if they don't believe that that's talking about Jesus, then there has to be a second new covenant that that's referring to.
Well, typically they would try to pigeonhole the covenants and say, well, this is dealing with the land covenant. Right. This is dealing with land and more temporal promises. And then we have the new covenant, capital N, capital C. It's the most important covenant. It's what saves. And Jews, yeah, they're not a part of that unless they have faith in Christ. But there's a separate covenant over here for them that they have that makes Israel God's chosen nation. It makes Jews God's chosen people, even though they die and go to hell without Christ. They have this covenant, at which point, you know, I think we want to be careful about over employing the word heresy, but that's pretty close. I think it's actually, it doesn't go as far as John Hagee's dual covenant theology, but that's dual covenant theology. Don't think it isn't.
Right. I mean, the fact that there's two simultaneous covenants for two different people, as opposed to, like, you know, the Noetic covenant to not flood the earth again, that's like, you know, broad promise to mankind, stuff like that. So
yeah, well, so the typical teaching on the covenants, and a lot of people don't understand this, even those that are Reformed, those who hold to what our critics call replacement theology, which is just, it's nothing but historic covenant theology that every Christian right. held to until about 1821 or so. Every Christian would have held that there is one covenant, there's one special people belonging to God, and that's Christians. And what trips a lot of people up is they confuse premillennial dispensationalism with historic premillennialism. So historic premillennialism is called that. It's called historic because it is, most scholars would agree, the oldest eschatology of the Christian church. And it's what you would call eschatologically futuristic. It's believing that not everything, but most things that we see in apocalyptic literature is futuristic, including a belief in a literal millennial earthly reign of Christ. And so people look at that represented in certain theologians throughout history, especially and even in antiquity, and they say, see, people always believe what we believe. What John Darby came up with was not that new. What Scofield wrote about was not that novel. But there's a huge disconnect there, and there's a huge misconception. There is a difference there is a difference in believing in a future eschatological role in redemptive history for Jewish people in the eschaton that's yet coming, that a lot of Christians throughout history have believed, and claiming, as Darby did, that Jews are currently right now, even in the state of their hardness of heart, the chosen special people of God with a separate covenant by which they get covenant blessings and promises outside of Jesus Christ. That's what distinguishes premillennial dispensationalism and historic premillennialism. You know, if someone is an amillennialist or a postmillennialist, you know, they can be pretty critical of eschatological futurism. But I'm a historic premillennialist. I believe that there will be a literal thousand-year millennium in which Christ reigns from Jerusalem. I believe that certain things will be accomplished by God among those who are ethnic Jews. That's orthodox. That's historic. There's nothing heretical about that. What Darby thought up is the heresy of alleging a separate covenant in which right now, even in their unbelief, they're special. And because of that, what you see in CUFI and John Hagee and the Jewish supremacy on evangelical Twitter is because of that, we have to coddle the Israelis. We can't criticize them. We have to support them, Mike Huckabee tells us. And we apply, or they apply, the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis 12:3 to modern Jews. And so that, as a matter of fact, I would say that is probably the biggest distinguishing mark between historic premillennialists and dispensational premillennialists. A historic premillennialist who's an eschatological futurist would say, yeah, possibly God does have some things in store in redemptive history for ethnic Jews that he will bring them to faith in Christ in a great, overwhelming way. Like, proportionally, we believe in the end, a lot of Jews are going to be saved, or whatever. But the premillennial dispensationalists would say the Abrahamic promise applies to Benjamin Netanyahu. And that is not something that any historic premillennialist would have agreed with throughout the course of church history until about 1821. The idea that I will bless those who bless, they say, Israel. Of course, we know that's not the wording of the Abrahamic promise. But they would say those who, you know, God will bless those who bless Israel and curse those who curse Israel, or Abraham, he'll curse. That has always been believed to be fulfilled among Christians and through Christians. Number one, because that's what Galatians 3 explicitly says. Like, Galatians 3 is probably the clearest demonstration of how to exposit an Old Testament scripture in all of the New Testament. And so in Galatians 3, the Apostle Paul is like, hey, here's what Genesis 12:3 says. Let me tell you how this ought to be interpreted. And he explains that the seed is not ethnic Jews. The seed is Jesus Christ. And the recipients, or the heirs of the promise, are those who are found in Jesus Christ and not ethnic Jews or anyone that doesn't have Jesus Christ. That would be the dividing line. Premillennial dispensationalists would think it applies to Israel, but no one prior to the 19th century would have thought so.
So you mentioned that, you know, people in the Reformed camp, covenant theologians, are at a disadvantage because, you know, a lot of Calvinists that had dispensationalist leanings were led into the camp, and, you know, John MacArthur being the most prominent example. And I think part of one of the reasons why there is a disadvantage is because John MacArthur being so famous, people don't necessarily, you know, people think that, you know, his version of dispensationalism is kind of more popularized. Can you kind of articulate how John MacArthur's views would differ, say, from what Ted Cruz believes in, or a lot of these other, you know, a lot of the people that are elevated in conservative media?
I don't know that Ted Cruz believes anything theologically per se.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, in that interview with Tucker, he doesn't know where the Abrahamic covenant is in in the Bible. I've listened to some transcripts from his dad, or read some transcripts from his dad, Rafael Cruz, who's a New Apostolic Reformation guy. I'm almost positive that it was a sermon basically that Ted Cruz delivered at the Thousand Pastor Summit at the Friends of Zion event with Mike Huckabee in Israel last week. I'm almost positive that Ted got that from his father, either pulled it from some notes from his dad or his dad wrote that for him. I don't think Ted Cruz has a theological bone in his body. He's just a neocon that wants as much war as is humanly possible.
But it's ironic because, you know, he was a neocon in, you know, 2015 when he opposed intervention in Syria or in Libya and stuff like that. I just thought that was pretty ironic. So he definitely, he changed, I think.
It appears like he is just sold out. Ted Cruz has disappointed me easily more than any other politician in the last decade.
I name drop Ted Cruz, but you know what I'm saying. Like,
what would
average dispensationalist?
Yeah, what would differentiate, say, MacArthur's dispensationalism from Scofield is MacArthur is less systematized. He's what you call a leaky dispensationalist, which is like, okay, instead of saying that these are the precise dispensations of the church, it's a little bit less formalized, certainly less obnoxious. And it's a lot less energy to try to defend from an apologetic viewpoint. But still, it has that main dual covenant error that ethnic Jews have blessings and promises that Gentiles don't have. And in terms of theology, you know, frankly, that's unconscionable. From there, that's the gateway to all sorts of rabid heresy, including the types of dispensational Zionism and neo-Judaizing that you see happen on X every day.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Oh, so, okay, man, I was muted. So my bad. What do you think, is the connection between a lot of the Judaizing and Christological and, or Trinitarian heresy? Because I see that a lot of these prominent Judaizers, they reject, Christ's divinity, and they, you know, they would claim that, you know, Bryson Gray would be an example. Brandon Tatum would be an example. I want to say that the people who founded or funded the Daily Wire are also in this category as well.
You know, to be honest with you, I've not seen that a whole lot. I'm probably not in the same well of heretics that you're plumbing every day. It might be a slightly different, you know, the algorithm is not pushing that stuff.
Well, when I made the points about Hanukkah on social media, it's like, you know, you got like a lot of people that were denying the divinity, or you had a few people, but you know, probably Bryson Gray's crowd, you know, Christian rapper and stuff like that, right?
What offends me the most is you have people jumping in to defend the Israeli people, right? They're taught in church that if they love Jesus, they have to support Israel. That's all they know. Okay. And we really shouldn't take it out on them that bad. I mean, they're sheep without a shepherd. They've been poorly catechized. They're just being foolish, and they don't know it. But you'll see people chime in and as you said, deny the divinity of Christ, but they will deny sola fide. They'll jump in there with the John Hagee Jews don't need Jesus thing, all sorts of rank heresies. And I don't see the YRR, the Reformed Baptist guys, the Proud Presbyterians, and most of the guys who haven't shut up about Calvinism for the last decade. You know, all they talked about was election and covenant theology and how dispensationalists were stupid. And yet here we are in this hour where the neo-Judaizing heresy is growing rampant. It's out of control right now. Where right. are these guys out at with their corrections? They're totally quiet. And then you have guys like Doug Wilson, who he is an arch covenant theology guy. He takes covenant theology too far and into federal vision, for crying out loud. Like it's covenant theology on steroids, gone way too far with Doug Wilson. And yet he'll talk about the Jews in dispensational language. And it's like, what is happening right now? What is happening?
I saw that he had a debate with Steve Dace at AmFest coming up on Israel. I'm like, what do they disagree on?
I don't know. What would they
disagree? And they don't represent any sides of that issue because Steve Dace should admit he's a dispensationalist.
Doug might voice a theological disagreement, but when you hear him defend Israel, the body politic, it's with the same type of affection and argumentation that dispensationalists do it. I mean, consider, for example, Owen Strand is a covenant theologian the last time I checked.
And yet, I wish I knew, but yeah, I don't know what his real theology actually is.
He was, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but Strand's Reformed, right? Like he was in there at the heat of the Reformed resurgence.
I know people always throw Trinitarian.
What happened to that?
I know people always throw Trinitarian heresy allegations at him because he follows Bruce Ware and stuff like that.
Well, I think Owen Strand is one of many evangelical influencers that, and I've written quite a bit about Owen Strand, actually, if that's how you say his last name. I'm not exactly sure, but
I think it is.
I've written quite a lot about him because he's in the field of what is called public theology. And that was invented by an LCMS pastor, Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, in the 1980s. And the idea is that churches or denominations, synods, if you will, presbyteries, they would hire theologians who would go speak prophetically to the culture to explain Christian theology to the lost. And then here you've got one of the most prominent public theologians of our time, Owen Strand, since when he was a kid, has been the lead senior CEO, head guru, top cheese of a number of prominent evangelical organizations, starting with the Council on Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, one after the other, with no other, it's really weird, like with no credentials or anything, like since he was in his 20s, they're like, hey, run this giant organization. And then when the grant runs out, he goes and runs a different one. But his entire vibe as a public theologian is to lecture Christians and to preach to the church on behalf of an organization that's not ecclesiastical, that's funded by dark money, that's funded by dollars that have clearly, for all I know, they've come from the world somehow, that they're not given from the offering plate to their organizations, those organizations. And on behalf of them, he tries to steer and direct the Christian church. It's a complete inversion of Christian public theology. Like it's the opposite of what public theology not that long ago was invented to do. And so Owen Strand gives theological hot takes that his donors or board, whoever they are, quite mysteriously, want him to promote, kind of like in a public relations sense. And so that's why you can't find him taking any difficult positions whatsoever. And he's right there on X, along with, you know, the greatest examples of theological vapidity, tweeting things like Jesus was a Jew, you know, like a statement like that. Jesus was a Jew and he had Jewish disciples and the book is a Jewish book. You know, just things like that, that don't, they're vapid, they're vain, they're empty, they're shallow. They don't make a point, but they sound like one just to get likes and applause from people. And so that's why I produced a couple works lately at Insight to Insight, to help equip Christians theologically with the resources necessary to take on these issues through a systematic or theological lens, because that's not being done. And I don't see very many people doing it, and I wish that they would. What I mean by that is, when we challenge dispensational Zionism or Jewish supremacy, we can't just do it with memes. Although I like memes as much.
It is fun.
Guy. Yeah, it is. It's fun. And with one-liners in like an X tweet battle, at a certain point, we have to be doing the work of theologians, equipping people to teach them from the scripture why these things are either heretical or dangerously heterodox. And so the first one you mentioned, which is the book, A Critique of Christian Anti-Semitism, that's available at my Buy My Coffee store, or the Insight to Insight. All subscribers get a free copy. And frankly, if you don't have the money, send me a message on X, send an email to me, send me a message through Substack, and just ask for a free copy. I'll be happy to send you a PDF of the book. The other one is a 6-part series. I've gotten through half of it now. We just finished week 3, called God Keeps His Promises, Understanding Zion and the True Israel of God, where I basically give an explanation and a defense of what our critics call replacement theology, to basically say, this is historic Christian orthodoxy. It's what has conventionally been called covenant theology. This is not the prominent view of the church throughout history. This was the only view of the church throughout history until 1821. If someone wants to argue Darby wasn't the first, they will have to find someone in that same era. I mean, pinning down exactly where it started is not that easy, but the Plymouth Brethren is as good as guess as any. I mean, it was called Darbyism for 50 years for a reason, right?
Right.
By its critics. People need to be given the theological answers for why this is a dangerous and a pernicious doctrine. And so I would just encourage your listeners to check out those two works available to all my subscribers, or I don't know, maybe just do your own Bible study from the scripture, dig in and find out why the Abrahamic promise does not apply to the modern political ethno-state of Israel, or all the other issues that pertain to this discussion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good work that you're doing, because I do think that the memes, in some ways, have swayed the popular culture.
They've been very valuable.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, that should not be undercut. But I do think that there's a counter-reaction. And that's what a lot of this Judaizing, neo-Judaizing the church, you know, emphasizing Seder dinners, emphasizing, you know, Christians should be celebrating Hanukkah too. In fact, we should be doing it even more. There's right. a bit of that rising in the church, which I'm not, maybe it's a counter-reaction, but it might also be the logical conclusion, because I feel like generations ago, obviously a famous example being the Richard Nixon, Billy Graham tapes, you know, where they could have conversations about Jewish behavior in society. But, you know, fast forward 30 years and people in the church are unwilling to have those conversations because the indoctrination
It's so frustrating, because in social media spaces like the Reform Pub, a few years ago. I complained at the time that they're so eschatologically minded. They're focused on, say, for example, the difference between Presbyterian covenant theology and Reformed Baptist covenant theology. And there is a difference, what we might call 1689 federalism, and that these guys, when it comes to eschatology, are debating how many angels can dance on the head of a needle. And it's been kind of obnoxious that that has been their course of discussion, while all of these other very important cultural societal issues are going on right in front of us. Like when you or I were out there in front of the Black Lives Matter movement, explaining to Christians what cultural Marxism was, these guys were talking about eschatology and covenant theology in their Facebook groups. And you were probably right, like me, where you're like, would you guys please try to be of some use to the world in regard to what's happening right now in time and space? Like, maybe get your heads out of the clouds for a second and talk about something else besides covenant theology, please. And now this is the perfect moment. Like, we live in an hour where on the number one political talk show in the world, at the epicenter of the populist social revival, you're having this incredible discussion between Tucker Carlson and Ted Cruz regarding Genesis chapter 12:3. You would think that these people who've lived and breathed covenant theology all this time, who've gotten, you know, stupid theological tattoo, like, you've got Calvin is my homeboy t-shirts, and like this has been what you've lived and breathed for 15 years. Why have they gone silent now? And now they're on to some other irreverent issue that doesn't do the world any good at the moment. It's just like, you know, so many Christians are not discerning the times. It's almost like wherever the controversy is, they're controversy adverse. So like, they're going to go away from the fight instead of to it. We should really have a lot more backup in this discussion over Israel, a lot more backup from Reformed and Calvinist leaders. And frankly, they're all being a bunch of pansies who don't come out and defend the truth. They just want to, you know, they want to have their little theological book club and preach to the choir about their little pet theological issues. And then when when society is talking about that issue, they disappear and go back to the back room because they don't want to be seen or heard from. I mean, it's frustrating.
Along those lines, a lot of these people who made entire ministries going after the prosperity gospel somehow ignore dispensationalism, even though, like, can you find is there a prosperity gospel preaching church that is not dispensationalist or pro-Israel?
No, I can't think of one.
Like, why is that never tied in? Like, wouldn't that be a natural lateral move, a way to advance their ministry a little bit? Like,
I mean,
I don't know why, you know, Justin Peters, Chris Rosebro is kind of sold out, but like, why didn't a lot of these people not pivot or, you know, expand their interest to kind of go after what's very much adjacent to what they've, you know, made their entire focal point? Is it just easy to go after?
Why is Justin Peters still talking about Todd Bentley and Benny Hinn? I mean, after all these years, well, I got a new video on Benny Hinn. Like, really? Like, is there anyone who's fooled by Todd Bentley at this point who isn't completely devoid of the Holy Ghost? Like,
that maybe people in the third world.
Maybe move on to what everyone, maybe, like, if you're a fireman, you should go to where the fires are. And so, like, I know his theology, so it's like, why are you being useless? Why not talk about this important issue over here? Or how about this? Everyone that was ranting and railing about cultural Marxism since 2017 and the Frankfurt School, and it's like, that's what really got me when I first got into this debate, when I heard Doug Wilson. I didn't hear him. It was in the Antioch statement, I think, where he said something about Jews taking over the world or whatever. as a conspiracy, and I thought about the Frankfurt School and where that came from and who invented cultural Marxism and who brought that to the United States. And so it's like, what, we're all going to pretend like Jews didn't bring us cultural Marxism? We're pretending like the Frankfurt School didn't happen?
Yeah, I was amazed when I saw a World War II documentary admit and basically say it's true, but it was sort of, you know, they kind of did the it's true, but it's not a bad thing. You know, connecting Jews to Bolshevism is the reason for anti-Semitism in Germany. I'm like, wait, they're actually admitting this?
James Lindsay and Michael O'Fallon were two of the biggest cheerleaders on that entire issue, explaining to us what cultural Marxism is, where it came from, how it originated. And like all of a sudden, we're not supposed to know or notice where it comes from, which like it cannot be separated from the milieu of Jewish thought in Germany from where it began, right?
Right.
It's just crazy. But back to the Pentecostal thing, I think you noticed something that I've noticed too, although I don't know that I've written anything about it, and that is the push that Zionism gets, particularly in the Pentecostal community. And you see this, I think, most illustrative with Mark Driscoll. So you could tell that Mark Driscoll wanted to kind of jump on your bandwagon with the, you know, the Christian Zionist movement, or excuse me, sorry, the Christian nationalist movement. He kind of tested which way the wind was blowing, that there's this populist movement, even theologically, going on in the United States. There is a record number of young men seeking God and trying to find theological answers. And so he wanted to capitalize on that. He came out as basically soft Christian nationalism. And then since then, we've seen him totally biff it on Israel, right? Like,
right.
He's an example of someone who I never would have called him reformed, although he would have called himself reformed. Here we have someone who absolutely holds to covenant theology. He's preached sermon series and written books basically on the topic, like from the perspective, at the least, of covenant theology. And yet he's taken this super weird, like one of these things doesn't belong type position on Israel. Well, the reason he's done that is because he landed in charismaticism after the fall of Mars Hill, right? So he wound up with the charismatics, because no matter how he hurt his reputation, the charismatics will always like restore you to ministry, basically. Like they will restore you. I mean, right. It took Michael Brown like 2 months and he's back after the butt padding, the serial butt padding throughout the course of his ministry.
I was definitely going to bring that up in my next question, but yes.
why does Mark Driscoll, despite the fact he's trying to be Mr. Christian nationalist, despite the fact he's a covenant theologian, why does he take the stance he does on Israel? And it doesn't fit with his theology at all. And the answer is because his donor base and his church is charismatic and they're all highly dispensational. So yeah, those things definitely go together.
Yeah. And I think what you're talking about, like obviously the memes, I think made it popular to not be dispensationalist online, but you're trying to take the next step to how do we bring this into the church? And yeah, you know, how do we do that? So I definitely appreciate that. Going back to Michael Brown, so we left off talking about how he's actively defending the Talmud, which is a holy text or unholy text for a different religion. And yeah, so what arguments is he bringing that maybe other people haven't brought before? Like some people say, oh, it's an encyclopedia, or, you know, it's like a blog and people just post different things to it and stuff like that.
It's just opinion. It's just a commentary. That's all it is.
Yeah.
I've called Michael Brown the devil's apologist for years. I had him. I think Michael Brown is the first guest I ever had on the Polemics Report way back when. And it was definitely a gotcha interview. And I got him on Benny Hinn. And he said, Benny Hinn is not a false prophet, despite the fact that he's prophesied falsely, because you have to prophesy falsely on purpose, intentionally, in order to be classified as a false prophet. So I've given him this nickname, Devil's Apologist, because anytime there was something just theologically indefensible in charismaticism, Michael Brown rides in his shining armor on a white steed and defends the person. He did that with the dead baby that Bethel Church was trying to resurrect from the dead. You remember that? Like they're praying over this poor corpse while it's rotting because they believed it was going to raise from the dead. You know, he defended Bethel from the Christian tarot card thing a few years ago. Like if there's something horrific, he's going to show up and he's going to flash his credentials and provide the intellectual work to get charismaticism out of the hot water that they've got themselves in. That's what he does. And he does that same thing with the Talmud. So he makes an apologetic defense for it in egregious ways. For example, he repeats the canard that the Yeshu in the Talmud is not Jesus, who's burning in hell, boiling in a cauldron of excrement, whose mother was a whore and who was a condemned sorcerer. And so he says, and this is what the Jewish ambassadors to Christianity would say. Like, so you understand that Israel relies upon the myth that Jews have this great love and respect for Jesus, right? Which is just, it's asinine. But that's what they tell us these days. And so he was giving their patented defense, which is, that's not Jesus. It doesn't say Jesus. It just says Yeshu, which is like pretty darn close to Jesus, right? But the thing
right,
is...
Right, we're talking like dialect of a Galilean dialect, right?
Right. So we have 1,400 years of history, polemics history, between Christians and rabbis on these texts, where up until the Zionist movement in the 19th century, they all admitted it was Jesus referring to Christ and defended it, that Jesus was a sorcerer who tried to betray Israel or lead them astray, and that he's in hell. And the only argument one could make is that, well, it's not saying he is in hell. It was a rabbi giving, like painting the picture of Jesus in hell. And what it is actually, Jesus comes out and he's talking in the story. And Jesus says, yeah, so my punishment is burning in hell because, you know, and he's contrite in hell. I led Israel astray. But it creates, certainly creates a picture of Jesus burning in hell in a pile of excrement. But it wasn't until, in terms of history, recently, like we're talking about 200 years ago, before any Jews denied that this was Jesus, they defended it contemporaneously with it being written. But furthermore, the Yeshu of what it speaks was put to death, it says, on the eve of Passover, put to death by hanging on a tree. How could you, with a straight face, write a book, metaphorically look Christians in the eyes, and say, that's not about Jesus? Who else was hung on a tree on the eve of Passover and murdered?
I mean, it's a Patrick Starr, that's not my wallet line that they're doing. It's like, no, right, it's clearly.
And he does the thing with the Talmud, too, where he's like, listen, the Mishnah and the Talmud, these are just commentaries, and Christians have John Owen on the shelf, but we don't think that John Owen is inspired. Listen, the Talmud repeatedly, go look at my tweet history where I've been laying out the quotes lately. The Talmud says repeatedly over and over again that it is to be revered and honored in a way that is even higher than the Torah. It is what defines and explains. It is the authoritative word of the Torah. it says that those who study the Talmud will have greater honor before God than those who study the Torah. It's simply a lie to say that they don't consider it inspired or authoritative or just as authoritative as the Torah. It is an understatement to say that they consider it as authoritative. They revere it to a higher degree than the Torah. That's a fact. And any Jew who's telling you differently is lying to you. You know, the Talmud gives the death penalty to Christians who study it. They don't want us to read it because it's as horrific as you have heard. And so you have all of these cases historically. I've written about a number of them at Smite Club, which is like the sub blog of Insight to Insight, historically, where, you know, it was in Frankfurt. Johann, I'm trying to remember his name. Anyways, the Jewish bankers in Germany got the prints, more or less, to buy up every copy and then destroy them of a book that the individual wrote exposing the Talmud. But they don't want us to read it. They don't. And by the way, that's, there are so many cases of censorship of Christians, of powerful Jews within several different societies in the last 700 to 800 years, when we try to expose the Talmud and what it teaches. And the same thing happens today. And you had it in that book from Michael Brown defending the Talmud. And of course, he, you know, it, every canard you can imagine. John Chrysostom was an anti-Semite. Martin Luther was an anti-Semite.
Constantine.
Yeah.
Usually, you know, kind of Augustine, the beginning.
Apparently every church father was an anti-Semite. But you know, what I didn't know at the time that I wrote my retort and published the ebook is that Michael Brown is a consultant, a hired paid consultant for FIRM, the Fellowship of Israel Related Ministries. FIRM is funded, supported, essentially managed by numerous agencies within the Israeli government, including the Israeli Department of Foreign Strategy or something like that. Basically, there's their version of the State Department. They are funding FIRM, which is sort of the mothership of all of these various evangelical quote-unquote ministries in the United States, whose sole purpose is to affect the view of American evangelicals of the Israeli state. And that's how they avoid the Farah filings, foreign agents, whatever it was. You know, if you are a lobbyist for a foreign agency, you have to register with Farah. That's what they got Hunter Biden on.
American citizens have to do this, which is, you know, one of the, you know, Reddit level defenses of, you know, it's American citizens.
Because they still have to register. Because it is religious. And right. They know that there's not a politician that wants to be perceived as challenging the First Amendment. It passes, it flies. And so evangelical Americans are a huge voting bloc. We vote rather, you know, homogeneously, monolithically. We vote in a bloc.
80%+, yeah.
If evangelicals will support Israel, what that means is, given the share of votes that we represent in the Congress, Israel can get whatever they want, so long as we have this idea in our head that God wants us to give money to Israel for them to buy bombs to blow up babies. And so they are spending millions of dollars each year through FIRM to put together these various lobbying organizations. They put speakers in churches. They write our Sunday school literature. They review literature. They produce small group material. These are Jews who are not, they're not Christian Jews. They're not Messianic Jews. These are Jews putting together these organizations, crafting literature for Christian organizations and churches. Basically, as they, Israel calls it, quote unquote, public diplomacy efforts. It's propaganda that's getting into our churches that is pushing dispensational theology for the purpose of giving Israelis our treasure, our national treasure. That's
what it's, prominent examples of this, or prominent, you know, other than Michael Brown, because you've definitely alluded to him. I think you posted a graphic multiple times that had a lot of faces on it. Any prominent examples of some of the material? Is there like a best hits book that maybe was a part of this, or speakers?
I put those articles together pretty quickly. I would just encourage, I think all of them are on this side of the paywall. I don't think you have to have a paid subscription to read those. But Greg Laurie was a prominent name. George Barna, and his work has been used extensively. So George Barna pulls evangelicals and then goes to Tel Aviv and sells them the research for them to know how to best manipulate evangelicals. It's a real Judas Priest move from George Barna. By the way, I don't know if you knew it, but that guy's theology is all jacked up.
I know Barna as a company is pretty woke. They're basically in bed with Ed Stetzer and stuff like that.
That's that is accurate. Kind of Barna is what you call a sectarian minimalist heretic.
Oh, really?
So sectarian minimalism is basically pulling out of quote unquote organized religion. Basically, it's to dismantle the organizational structure of the Christian church, if not the church altogether. Barna's Pagan Christianity, I said at the time that I read it, more than 15 years ago probably, or close to, that it is the most dangerous book I've ever seen marketed to evangelicals. So Barna's a bad dude. Anyways,
oh, wow.
He's providing, it's similar to, you know, at one time, Ed Stetzer took Lifeway research that he was paid to do by the Southern Baptist Convention and handed it over to Democrat think tanks for them to better understand how to manipulate Southern Baptists and conservative evangelicals. Barna did basically the same Judas Priest move and is providing this this to firm. Let me see. I said Greg Laurie already. You can probably see the graphic. You know, these are individuals that are big, big names. Jentison Franklin was another one. Obviously, Jonathan Kahn, but that clearly goes without thinking. Most, but not all, are charismatics. And they're literally providing the window. They're opening the window for people to creep in unawares into the church to lead us captive into vain philosophy and empty deceit. Exactly what Paul warns about. Men who are not brothers, men who long ago, Paul says, were designated for destruction, and they are sneaking into the church privily. It says they're coming in secret to spy out our liberties and to lead us captive into vain philosophy and empty deceit. So that's what these guys on the graphic you're showing are doing against the church on behalf of who Paul says are the enemies of Christ. And that's
what's pretty interesting is that you have a nicely visualized here. And I remember it was a Jerusalem Post, I think, ran an article that, you know, evangelical leader, you know, condemns anti-Semitism or whatever. And it cited Mike Evans of Friends of Zion. And it's like,
yeah,
who is this guy?
So it's like, that was what sent me down this rabbit hole. I didn't know any of this. I hadn't seen this somewhere. I didn't like swipe an article. Like all my articles are like my independent research. So I saw Mark Levin, a tweet where he quoted who he called prominent evangelical leader, Mike Evans. And I thought, I'm pretty clued in on who people are in evangelical. Right. I've never heard of him. Who is that guy? And so I saw that he was president of Friends of Zion. And so immediately it's a warning bell, right? Like, okay, he's not a prominent American evangelical. He's a shill of the Israeli government. It turns out that's exactly what he is. So Friends of Zion is, they have what they call a museum in the Israeli tourist sector. Anytime there is a big evangelical event, it will be hosted at the Friends of Zion Museum. They do no evangelism. I could not find in any of their material any reference to Jesus evangelistically. I saw nothing directed towards Jews referencing their need for salvation through Christ. None whatsoever. So I wouldn't really call it a ministry. But it is basically the pass-through organization between, I think the article had three different, maybe four. Yeah, it's four. If you want to read those, I can't see them. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Israeli Allies Foundation.
Ministry of Tourism, which, you know, wine and dining evangelicals with Israel and the paid trips and stuff like that, I would imagine is related to that.
The Ministry of Strategic Affairs. So all of these organizations are basically the funders of Friends of Zion, along with American evangelicals. So grandmas in churches all across America are putting their milk and eggs money into the offering plate, and it's being sent there to Friends of Zion. Friends of Zion then pays for various municipal projects in Israel, no evangelism whatsoever. So they get money from the United States and give it to Israel, and they get money from the Israeli government to affect the messaging for evangelicals in the United States, okay, to basically manipulate our views. And so it was only 2 days after I wrote the article about the Friends of Zion that I saw this massive event in Israel of 1,000 American pastors on a Potemkin tour, which is basically like a state-sponsored propaganda tour of Israel, where they are all preached to by Ted Cruz and Mike Huckabee and told to, quote, set their pulpits on fire for Israel. And so, I mean, just think about how tragic that is. Their eschatological hope from Romans 11 is that all of Israel will be saved. My personal theological belief is that Paul in Romans 11 in that verse is defining Israel the same way he defined it in Romans chapter 9, which is those who believe in Christ are the true Israel. So obviously all of Israel is going to be saved, because definitionally Israel is only those who believe in Christ. That's not their perspective. They think that means one day every Jew is going to be saved. Well, then I would ask, why don't they seem the slightest bit interested in winning Jews to Christ? And yet you can't find it. When you pick up the Bible and you read the apostolic epistles, you see that they were very focused. John, Peter, and Paul, all very focused on convincing Jews, repeatedly preaching at them that they have no blessings, no promises, no special status before God because they are Abraham's descendants. They are told that, screamed that in almost every epistle that is written in the New Testament. It's like Paul is clapping his hands, stamping his feet, screaming out at the audience, you are profited nothing without Christ. God's not a respecter of persons. To him, there's no Jew, there's no Greek. God is not looking at people through these categories anymore. Everyone who believes is a child of Abraham and an heir of God's promises, whether Jew or Gentile. And if you don't believe in Christ, guess what? Not all who are of Israel are of Israel, and you don't belong to God. So the Apostle Paul, or the apostles rather, Paul, Peter, John, all of them, focused on that narrative to Jews. You're not special. You're not special. You're not special. And then come these crazy dispensational Zionists who you would think would be interested in preaching the gospel to Gentiles, and their only message to Jews is, you're special and we're here to support you. It is the opposite of a gospel witness.
And it doesn't seem like it's very effective. You know, just as a casual observation, I don't see how it's effective.
The percentage of Christians in Israel is shrinking dramatically. Now, if you listen to the propaganda, you'll see that the number of Christians in Israel is growing. This is true technically, but only because of the growing population.
Right, birth rates.
It's expats, and there's obviously a nativist Arab Christian population. You know, the Christian population in Palestine was in the 1940s almost 15%.
And now it's 16 for sure.
It's like one or two now. So like, yeah. You know, they're basically being, well, they're being genocided clearly right in front of our eyes. You know?
Yeah. I was very surprised to learn that the nation of Jordan had a higher percentage Christian population than Israel, but they're always like, oh, Israel's the only place in the Middle East with a growing church. And
First of all,
it's like, if you start the timeline, you know, you ignore a lot of the timeline on, you know, the church decreasing in Israel.
Well, there's twice as many Christians in Qatar,
right,
than there are in Israel. And it's a much higher percentage of the population.
Now, a lot of those were probably Filipinos or something that are imported, but still, you know, to bring the gospel to Qatar.
Yeah,
we should have.
That's fair. I mean, they're mostly expats there also. However, that's not the case in Palestine or in Gaza.
Right.
These are Christians who have been there, you know, since the first century. One of the dumb things I hear the Jewish supremacists say on X is, hey, if it wasn't for Israel, who would take care of our Christian heritage sites? And it's like, who do you think took care of them for 1900 years?
Yeah, even under Islamic rule.
Yeah, the Ottomans had basically a law that these sites had to be preserved, because keep in mind, Muslims have a significantly higher view of Christ than what Jews do. You know, the Quran teaches that Jesus was of God, not the Son of God, but of God, that he was a true prophet. It teaches that he was born of a virgin. The Quran teaches that Jesus is coming again. So they have their own reason to protect the sites that are of historic significance to Christians, because they're of historic significance to Muslims also. But the nativist Christian families, the Arabs in Palestine, they've been taking care of this these sites for literally thousands of years. Some of the single families have been taking care of them 700 or 800 years. And so that population is shrinking. So there's no revival, Christian revival, that's happening in Israel, because it does persecute Christians. You know, one thing that I wrote about in the last couple of weeks that surprised a lot of people is that the right of return excludes Jews from returning to Israel who have embraced Christ. So if they're an ethnic Jew, if their relatives are actually from, say, Palestine, you know, as opposed to the Europeans who moved there and called themselves Jews, let's say they're actually from there. Their grandparents lived through the Holocaust, but they embraced Christ yesterday. They can't go get citizenship in Israel.
Yeah, assuming they find out, right?
What's that?
Assuming they find out.
Yeah, well, I mean, the law says they can't. So if in the immigration process that comes out, you would assume that Christians wouldn't lie about it. You know, I'm sure maybe some would to get citizenship, but really not sure there's ever a reason to lie about being a Christian. What is that if that's not obvious persecution? And so just talk to the Christians in Gaza sometime about what they think about their treatment at the hands of the Israeli government. And so
that's kind of fascinating. Even Voice of the Martyrs, which is kind of like your standard, you know, Christian persecution ministry, they mark Israel as a little shade of red. It might not be the darkest shade of red on the map, but it is a little shade of red.
Yeah, and to be fair, obviously there's worse places. Like, yeah. We're not saying it's the worst,
But it's definitely it's definitely hyped up as a lot friendlier than it actually is.
Here's my impression, though.
I don't even think evangelical Christianity is recognized there. Like, the closest we got is Anglicanism.
I believe strongly that if the Israelis did not feel that evangelical Christians were a useful political tool to get what they wanted out of Washington from our public coffers, I think that Christians would be rounded up and expelled from Israel. You know, you can't convince me that whatever privileges Christians may share in Israel, that it's entirely due because they need stuff from us. And I say that because when there are Christians that they don't need stuff from, like the Palestinians that live within the borders of their country, you know, they get missiles shot through the church six different times since Gaza was invaded, on most occasions with people gathered for worship or for other church functions. They're shooting at churches. So I don't know why that doesn't qualify as Christian persecution, but these are all things that we're not free to discuss without being accused of anti-Semitism or being a Nazi or you must love Hitler, because Jewish supremacy basically says, no matter what, you can't criticize Jews. And I see that in the discussions about Gaza, where, you know, at a certain point, when you see a civilian death toll that is 2,092% higher than other modern NATO conflicts,
right?
9 out of 10 victims being non-combatants. At a certain point, you just have to stop the facade, like stop pretending like they're not targeting civilians. And you get Christians.
Yeah,
to that.
If anything, I'd respect them more if they just owned it and said, like, "Yeah, we're eradicating people that you don't like."
Well,
they
I mean,
be thanking, like, they should actually like own it, like Saddam Hussein did during his trial or whatever.
On October 9th, they, you know, Netanyahu invoked the Elamites, Amalekites rather, in terms of the treatment that they were going to get. So, like, he's telling you, we're going to genocide these people,
right?
By invoking Amalek. But anyways, when you get Christians to finally admit it, because they can't deny it any longer, what's happening in Gaza, it's basically like, yeah, but I'm going to defend them anyway, because I don't want to be cursed by God and I want to be blessed by God. And it's like, okay, you are supporting a bunch of Europeans who observe the occult, Kabbalah, which is occultic, and Talmudic Judaism, which is not the religion of Moses or Abraham, of ethnic Europeans. Netanyahu's Polish. You're supporting a white guy putting missiles through churches in Gaza and murdering people that are more genetically related to Abraham than they are.
Right.
You're literally supporting Israel killing the actual literal genetic heirs or offspring of Abraham, not through Jacob, but through Esau. I mean, through Ishmael, but like, they're dying. What are you doing?
Right. Going back to the graphic, real quick, Faith by Works. What can you tell me about that organization? Just kind of, yeah, what's the big picture of what they are?
So Faith by Works is the organization that we found out about because of the FARA filings. Whenever you see the $7,000 meme and, you know, influencers are being paid $7,000 to
and then geofencing campaigns as well.
Yeah, the geofencing campaigns, which since then their publicist PR people said, well, we never actually did that. We just said we were going to. I don't believe that. Now, what I released recently was a spreadsheet that not a lot of people have seen. It wasn't the original information. It was a follow-up of all of the churches that it said had been successfully reached. There's a little bit of unclarity as to whether or not those churches agreed to partner with Faith by Works, or if Faith by Works just successfully infiltrated them and propagated them, you know, their propaganda. Not sure which exactly, but it lists all of the various organizations, university groups, parachurch ministries, and congregations throughout America pushing, you know, Israeli propaganda. So the geofencing thing was people that show up to that address where the church is, their cell phones will then be targeted with advertising with propaganda for most of the time was promoting, supporting the war effort in Gaza. So they really need those bombs to keep coming, right? Israel's the only country that receives American military financial assistance that is permitted to spend a percentage of that money on their own war industry. So Israel makes money by blowing people up.
Right, and because the distinction there is that, you know, we give aid to, say, you know, Europe, they have to buy American.
Right. And I think it's only 15% or something, but given a nation the size of Israel, that's a lot. And so they need our resources and our money because they have very much a war economy. You cannot understand the Israeli lust for conflict until you understand how their entire economy is driven by war and conflict, and not just in Israel. I mean, it was revealed a couple days ago that the Israelis were pushing Trump for regime overthrow, regime change in Venezuela. Like they are the hub of the global industrial war complex. And so, you can't understand Israel without understanding that. So, you know, you go to church, you worship God, and on your way home, you know, you get a targeted ad, and maybe for the next week or two, promoting just some Zionist nonsense in your phone. So that's what Faith by Works is, the only one of those three organizations I've written about that has filed with Farah, and the other two have not.
All right. I think it might be time to go to the questions of the people.
Yeah, I've got a few more minutes before I got to go, but I don't have a lot longer.
One of the questions was your thoughts on the Kabbalah, because you brought that up earlier. Can you just give an overview of that? Because that definitely, if you study European history, you know, Kabbalah readers definitely shows up. It showed up in Russian history that I was reading, when, you know, homosexuality was rising in Russia and it was tied to the Kabbalah and stuff like
that. So the best way that I can explain that is think about all the various Canaanite religions going back to Mesopotamia that Israel was repeatedly dabbling with, that God would punish them for embracing those gods. For example, Remphan. Molech, Asherah, and so on, Baal. Kabbalah is essentially a conglomeration of all those various Eastern deities put through an occultic lens with a little bit of a Jewish spin. So most people will admit, I mean, it's not really conspiratorial, that the Star of David was first a Kabbalah symbol. Well, Kabbalah is also influenced heavily by Remphan and the worship of this false god that used the star that is condemned in the Bible. That's why we know it is, in fact, the Star of David. And so it's very esoteric. It's a little bit what you would call woo-woo. Okay, so it's very New Agey, because if you understand the New Age, then you understand that the New Age is not that new. It's Eastern mysticism. And so think of it as Jewish flavored Eastern mysticism is how I would describe Kabbalah. And furthermore, the percentage of observant Jews who observe Kabbalah is, I don't want to quote a figure. I wanted to say 90%. I don't know that it's that high, but the special amulets, Kabbalah amulets, that you'll see hang from a lot of Israeli stoops or the doorposts of the home, from the rear view mirror in the cars. These are all Kabbalah images. So it's a huge, I wouldn't even say that observant Judaism in Israel is completely Talmudic. It's like 30% Kabbalah, 70% Talmudic. So it's
a huge. I think the Talmud is more of an underlying ethos to the culture than it is like actively read and studied. It's kind of like,
I want
Antichrist, and then you're kind of building an ethics system that, again, the Jews versus non-Jews have completely different rules.
Well, and you have you have the different sects of Jews, whether it's Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox and so on. But it's about 99% of Jews worldwide embrace the Talmud. So only about, it's less than 1%. They're called Karaite, K-A-R-A-I-T-E, Jews. They're about 1%. There's about 30,000 of them worldwide don't embrace the Talmud. The rest of them do. So what they do with it, different sects do with different things and study it to different degrees.
All right. That was a question of the people. I know you said you have to get on out of here. We alluded to where we can find you, Insight to Insight.
Yeah. Those, the two books I mentioned, a critiquing Christian anti-Semitism. It's available at my Buy My Coffee store for Insight to Insight, or all premium subscribers have gotten the book for free. And all premium subscribers can get the 6-part series, the theological defense, more or less, of what our critics call replacement theology, called God Keeps His Promises. So we're in week 3. We're about ready to go to Greek 4. Week 4. If you become a premium subscriber, you get access to the full archives. And at the end of the 6 weeks, that will be published as a collection, as a book. And it comes complete with small group study, family, home devotion questions, and a study guide for you to really learn and get into that subject. All that can be found at Insight to Insight.
All righty. Thank you for coming on. And as for the rest of you, have a blessed day. Stay based, Christ is King, and we will catch you on the next one.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.